And we are going to go on to the last case of the day, which is Appeal 044112, United States of America versus Hawk. And it's Mr. Karp.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I represent the appellant, Quill Hawk. Simple issue. Was this a reasonable and fair sentencing? And it was clearly not. Mr. Hawk was charged with distribution of 7 grams of powder. This was one of these cases that lied in the cusp between this court's pronunciation in Booker and the United States Supreme Court pronunciation in Booker. There was a plea agreement whereby the plea agreement spoke of relevant conduct of 100 grams of powder, which was more conduct than was charged either in the count or in the sentencing allegation.
Mr. Karp, could I ask you, just to kind of cut to the chase, as I see it, there are really sort of two issues here. One is whether the statement you made at the sentencing hearing, in which you say we do take the utmost exception to the calculations in the addendum, is enough to preserve your argument that the crack shouldn't be part of the relevant conduct. That's question one. And I guess question two is whether we really are looking at a procedural problem here or a substantive problem, because what's missing, as far as I can tell from this record, is a consideration by Judge Crabb of whether the evidence supports, by the usual old-fashioned sentencing guidelines methodologies, a finding that the crack was there. Judge Crabb, in this difficult interim period that this case came up in, says, I'm just going to do this as discretion. She sort of skips over that intermediate step of saying, yes, there's reliable evidence that it's so much of this and so much of that, and therefore I'm going to select this sentence. Because in the post-Booker world, where the guidelines are advisory, we do still expect the district judges to use the guidelines. So it's hard to say that the ultimate sentence is one that would have been impossible.
Absolutely, but the judge does have to consider them. And
which strikes me as kind of a procedural point. You want a procedural remand so that she can march through the steps of finding relevant conduct?
No, Your Honor.
We want
a full sentencing here, resentencing. It was clearly unfair.
What would that get you? I mean, she's going to go through and see what controlled substances were part of his 1B1.3 relevant conduct, right? Among other things.
And whether it was crack, and whether it was, in fact, relevant conduct related. I've got a lot of questions. Go. Okay.
Yeah, forgive me, but at pages 3 and 4 of your reply brief, you laid out what you think are the problems with the factual basis for the quantity. But did you make those types of specific objections in the district court?
Judge Rovner, I think that ties in very much also to Judge Wood's question.
Right,
which is, there's a couple of different ways to approach that. One, there was a plea agreement. Two, the pre-sentence investigation report went along with the plea agreement, saying 100 to 200 grams powder, and we were fine with that. There was no objection. There's no root, and that, so we didn't miss a deadline in terms of objection. Next, at the sentencing hearing, I let the judge know we disagreed with the new calculation and we objected under Booker. Just the fact that I said Booker under the Macedo case, which Judge Williams authored, that should have been enough.
Other than saying we do take the utmost exception to the calculations in the addendum and we don't agree with those, I'm wondering whether you gave Judge Crabb any reason to think you were challenging the evidence underlying the proposed findings on the amount of crack for which Mr. Hawk should be held responsible. Because even up here, it wasn't until the reply brief that you specifically challenged the basis for the quantity finding. And, you know, let me just say this. Judge Crabb is a particularly conscientious judge, it seems to me. And I think she would have resolved each of the objections that you're making now if she'd been alerted to what the objections were. And what I'm afraid of here is that she wasn't. Now, am I wrong?
I was told never, ever tell an appellate judge that she's wrong.
Oh, no, you can tell me I'm wrong. You can tell us
at
we're
the
wrong.
Plea here, at
we're
the
different. We three are different.
All right. Well, at the plea hearing, the judge asks the assistant U.S. attorney, just to be clear, in this plea agreement, are we talking about 100 to 200 grams of powder? And the government says yes. So there's no question about it at the plea hearing. It was crystal clear. And it was crystal clear in the pre-sentence report. And then we have at the last minute, we have a change whereby we have this 100-to-1 ratio just blowing up in our faces. The courts have to pay very careful attention to the application of the 100-to-1 increase in sentencing range. The effective result of this was an increase. This wasn't a small increase. An increase from 30 to 37 months to 121 to 151 months.
But your position would have to be that simply by saying we object to the calculations is enough to put everyone, you know, the government as well as the district court, on notice that it's now the government's burden to prove by the usual old preponderance of evidence that, you know, it was the whatever it was, you know, 118 grams of crack or thereabouts, 123, I forget how many. But anyway, enough to make this difference. Or you're under plain error. I mean, if you actually really didn't say anything about it, then it's probably just a forfeiture.
I think under Macedo we don't have to find plain error. I think there's actually plenary review. I think you clearly reached the merits. And even if it was plain error, this was such an unjust situation from Mr. Hawk's point of view. And basically having a last minute change that increases the sentence quadruples it, makes it four times what it was. Mr. Hawk had certainly given up something. He gave up the right to a possible windfall based on Booker because he only needed to admit 7 grams of powder for the offense of conviction. So he was giving something up, and the government was getting something by his admitting to the 113 grams of powder. No question it was powder. And the pre-sentence investigation report said, fine, it's powder. They went along with the recommendation. There was no need to object to it. And then we have this change at the last minute. So the addendum says base. It does not say crack. And very specifically, Your Honor was on the panel.
We all know the cases anyway. Yeah, so don't worry.
It has to be crack. It can't be just base. And the court failed to find that it was base, and that this was the first. This was the jumping off point for the sentencing. So the sentence is per se unreasonable if we're using the wrong guidelines range. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if the court will permit. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, boy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Peter Giroles for the United States. John Vaudry was the attorney down below. Your Honor, to go to the issue of the waiver, or rather the forfeiture.
It's not waiver, right. Yeah. I mean, it's at worst forfeiture. I'll tell you what I am concerned about, and I really do see this. I'm hoping that these cases will finally come to an end, these interim Booker cases, if you will. What we lack on this record is careful findings from the district court looking at some of the kind of evidence that the government is citing in its brief, whether it's grand jury testimony or other things. And I can, just off the top of my head, remember enough cases where we have reversed sentences because we've concluded that the district court based quantity determinations on nebulous eyeballing or these other nice phrases that we use, that I really feel like a step was missing here. And maybe the district court didn't appreciate in this very uncertain environment we were all working in between last June and this January that she still needed to do that under the guidelines. This was a time we thought they might all just go out the window, which I'm sure you remember all too well. So I'm very worried that for this kind of case, we really need the findings.
And Judge, if I could address that, if you look at it, you have to understand what was the reason for it not kind of coming up to fruition. And the reason was because the defendant never objected.
What did you mean by the calculations then? Why did the judge suddenly interpret that as a Booker instead of – Booker isn't about calculations. Booker's about the Sixth Amendment.
Right. Well, the answer was the calculations, in other words, the crack cocaine, was presented by the government in terms of this testimony and grand jury testimony. It wasn't admitted to by the defendant, and it wasn't found by a jury. And during that interim period, that was the critical factor.
Well, so, he says, we take the utmost exception to the calculations in the addendum. That could mean, of course, no jury finding, but it could also mean, you know, was it powder or crack, or was it, you know, 10 grams or 120 grams? It could mean a lot of things.
Except, Your Honor, as the court went on to say, they said, Mr. Karp, do you have anything more to say? You're preserving a Booker-Blakely argument. In other words, your client's not admitting to it, and the government hasn't proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you have anything more to say? And he says, no, I don't. That's
it. So he's saying, yes, I am making – he says, I'm making a Blakely argument indeed. And she says, okay, do you want to say anything more? And he doesn't add anything to it, but you have to read that as a Blakely argument to the exclusion of anything. And he's already said he's complaining about timeliness. Maybe this isn't enough. I don't know.
Well, Your Honor, except that if – that wasn't his argument, that he didn't say anything more. He said, I don't have anything more. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Hawk suggested that there might be some ambiguity in the evidence as to whether one or more of the witnesses was talking about 6/8 of an ounce or 6 to 8 ounces. Is there an ambiguity there?
Well, Your Honor, what you brought up is the stuff that occurs way back in his reply brief, which for the first time was raised before any court. And the question here is not whether there's an ambiguity with Mr. Martin, because Mr. Martin's testimony, who he's claiming there's an ambiguity with, that was really used to corroborate Mr. Jacoby and Mr. Wilbank's grand jury testimony. Mr. Martin never actually appeared before a grand jury. All he did was give a statement against penal interest. And so his statement about ripping off coke or crack, which is what the evidence surrounds the crack cocaine that's attributed to Mr. Hawk, that's the evidence that we're using Mr. Martin for, corroboration. And so the question about whether there is an ambiguity, whether there isn't, the pre-sentence report in the addendum talks about that. And so the question becomes, what did the court do when it made these determinations that the crack cocaine was involved? Well, as Judge Wood pointed out, it may not be overtly explicit because the defendant didn't object, but it's clear, number one, that the judge is using the crack determinations made because of the sentence between 121 and 151 months. And second, it's clear that the court, when it made those findings, had only crack evidence before it. In other words, the 121 and 151 months were based on Jacoby, Wilbanks, and Martin all talking about crack cocaine. So it isn't like there's ambiguity or there's contradictory evidence or anything else.
And there's never any judicial assessment that's visible to us anyway as a court of appeals of the reliability of those witnesses or whether there's overlap or whether any of the things.
Because nobody disputed it, Your Honor.
Well, which takes us back to plain error. I mean, it's
and And you, and if you, as the court knows, if you look at even the case that Mr. Karp cites, the Palmer decision on what constitutes adequate error or adequate preservation of it, in the Palmer case, what happened is the defendant objected. He contradicted the witnesses. He says, that is not what happened. He contradicted it. The court there said, well, there was no forfeiture in that case because the defendant basically didn't present enough evidence.
Right.
But he preserved it by making specific
claims. That's the regular error versus plain error argument. But if we are in the world of plain error, which is the one we may be in because of all of this, we're still faced with the fact that we have no district court findings that we can review other than all this inferential stuff you're arguing. We don't, we have a tenfold, maybe not quite that, but we have a very large increase in the sentence, fivefold. It's a very unsatisfactory state.
Well, if the court would, I suppose that the proper procedure in this case would have been, after the addendum was filed, for Mr. Quill to file the objections and say, we don't agree with these crack
cocaine calculations. I don't disagree with that, which again takes you back to forfeiture, and why shouldn't we notice it?
And under the plain error analysis, Your Honor, as I stated, the evidence is overwhelming that it was crack cocaine. There's nothing to contradict it. And because of that, there's only one inference that can be made.
But it's not like, was it crack cocaine? Because as you well know, under relevant conduct, we also have to make findings that it was in the same course of, as part of the same scheme and the part of the same program. We don't have a rule that's, once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer, everything's relevant to everything else. The government's frequently in here proving that this particular sale of crack cocaine was part of this course of conduct. They're just issues.
And I think that the court, in the district court at least, certainly did not commit error, but more important, did it commit plain error?
Mm-hmm.
And there was no substantial violation of the defendant's rights, and there was nothing to indicate that the error seriously affected the fairness or the public perception of the judicial proceedings. It just was simply the sentencing that occurred. So the government would argue that despite what might be perceived as these errors, they're not simply plain error.
Okay.
The court has no further questions. We'd ask you to affirm the district court's sentence as reasonable under Booker. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I got in trouble here for reading an opinion called Booker out of this court. And this court didn't say the guidelines are no good. It said they're mandatory, and they've got to be proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. So would it have made any sense for me to argue to the judge, oh, the government has to prove this to you, Your Honor? It would have been a fruitless argument, not in the posture we're in, not back in November of 2004.
Well, of course, you were on notice via the government's objection to the PSR and the probation officer's subsequent addendum to the PSR as to what the factual basis for the proposed finding was.
And perhaps I should have beefed up the objection, but the procedure we have in the Western District is there's a PSI, you
uh-huh.
file objections by a certain date, and here there was nothing to object to. We were fine with the PSI. There's no problem with it. It was clear that we were all talking about powder up until the buzzer rang. The indictment, so powder, the plea agreement, powder. At the plea hearing, judge said, it's powder, right? Government said, yes, it's powder. The PSI said, it's powder. So we were all on board until the last minute for it being powder, and then we have this sentence quadrupling on us. Thank you very much.
Did you want to say anything, though?
I clearly substantial rights were affected. If not the Sixth Amendment, then surely right to a fair sentencing and right to be sentenced based on proper findings certainly has due process implications. Full remand is mandated. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Yes, you were appointed, weren't you, Mr. Carr?
I had that honor.
Well, we had the honor of your very fine representation of your client, and we thank you for taking on that task. And we, as always, thank you as well, Mr. Jarosz, for your fine presentation. And for sitting here until case number 6. And your case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.